I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. The history of Native Americans has been one of conflicting stereotypes. In colonial days, the picture was of savage or savior. In the Revolution, it was enemy or ally. As the U.S. expanded westward, it was guide or militant objector. And when it comes to Indian reservations, it's surviving poverty or enjoying casino wealth. Award-winning novelist David Troyer is an Ojibwa Indian who grew up on a Minnesota reservation. His latest book, Res Life, looks at the history of these enclaves and what it means to live on one. Today we'll talk with him about how the reservation is viewed from both sides of the boundary. Plus, our friend Brian McTavish joins us with the weekend to-do list. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Amazingly enough, the Bureau of Indian Affairs doesn't keep track of how many Indian reservations there are in this country. The number is believed to be around 300 in about 30 states. But what's happening or not happening on those reservations is what's interesting. David Troyer has taken an inside look in his new book, Res Life, An Indian's Journey Through Reservation Life. Troyer is an Ojibwe from the Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota. He talks about hard-lived lives. On some reservations in the Dakotas, he points out that the median income hovers just above $10,000. The good news? Things are slowly getting better, but certainly not fast enough. David Troyer is the author of three novels. He's a professor of literature and creative writing at USC. He splits his time between Los Angeles and the Leech Lake Reservation. And David Troyer, so good to have you on the show. Thanks for taking some time today.
Thanks for having me.
How can it be, David, that the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which is where your father worked, doesn't know how many reservations there are in this country?
Well, like I say in the book, this might say something about the Bureau of Indian Affairs,
yeah.
Which is notorious for its, the nicest way to put it would be their lack of efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
The more accurate way to put it would be their incompetence over the years. And so this might say something about that incompetence, but it might also say something about reservations, which are anything but clearly defined and easy to understand. So it could be a compound problem.
And these reservations are scattered really throughout, I said, 30 states. Some of them are pretty small. Some of them as large as the state of Rhode Island, right?
Oh, that's absolutely true. There are some very small communities here and there, even in Kansas, right, where you are.
Right.
And then there are some reservations which are enormous. Navajo Reservation, White Earth Reservation, Pine Ridge, these places are huge.
Yeah. Well, you are, as I mentioned, Ojibwe, and you're from the Leech Lake Reservation in Minnesota. Describe that reservation to us, David.
Well, it's I feel lucky to be Ojibwe and proud to be Ojibwe and proud to be from Leech Lake. It's a bigger reservation compared to many. It's 40 by 40 miles. Inside the reservation boundary, there's farmland, forests, swamps, lakes, rivers. The Mississippi flows through Leech Lake Reservation. And then that's the landscape. And then on that landscape are communities, a city of 3,000, smaller towns and villages of 100 people, 200 people, and then people who just live way out in the woods, kind of like I did. I didn't grow up in a village. I grew up kind of, out in the sticks.
How prosperous or not so prosperous are folks who live there?
Well, that's the thing. The image of reservations is that they're places of want and woe, where there is only hardship to be found. But the fact is, although there is lots of hardship to be found in lots of places, there's also a much broader range of experiences and incomes than, among other things, than we'd expect. So, on Leech Lake, there are very wealthy Leech Lakers who've made their money in business or who knows how, and then there are very poor Leech Lakers, and so there's a whole range. And that's what was so exciting about the book. There's a range of economic, there's a range of, in terms of class, also in terms of religion, in terms of mental health. There's a huge, complex range of people, which is really actually wonderful to notice.
And that's one thing, one reason you wrote the book, right? You wanted to set the record straight because, as you say, a lot of folks think of Indian reservations and they think of nothing but poor people.
That's exactly right. And that goes for us, too. I mean, this is not just a problem that outsiders have. It's a problem our near neighbors have, non-Native neighbors, but it's also a problem that we have. You know, we persist in seeing our experience as basically an experience of poverty or an experience of destruction. And frankly, I don't think the astounding thing is what we've gone through as peoples for the last 500 years. What's astounding is not what we've lost. What's astounding is what we've maintained. Hmm. And I wanted a way to remember that.
Yeah, because you call reservations, I thought this was such an interesting phrase, places of surplus, which again is just the opposite of what most people think. Why do you call them places of surplus?
Well, you know, if you shift the way you think, then there's a corresponding shift in what you're able to see. If we only think of reservations as places of poverty, then that's all we're going to see in ways that don't help change that poverty. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I probably wouldn't argue with that vision if it was actually effective, you know, if it helped people,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think it does. And so I was desperate in the book to find some other way of seeing, some other way of thinking, and so that what is seen would expand, would become more active. And it seemed to me that surplus was the way to see things. We have a surplus of poverty, but we have too much poverty.
Yeah,
that's one way to look at it.
Yeah.
But we have a surplus of, you know, of hustle too, so it kind of changes the way you see things when you change the framework that you use to think things through.
Well, maybe one way to change the way we think is to talk a little more about your own home at Leech Lake. And if I remember correctly, if you walk out your front door, you can pretty much drop a fishing line in the water and fish for evening meals. Am I right?
That is absolutely true. We've been really lucky, you know, to have a home on the reservation, and it's a place of incredible beauty. To me, it's the most beautiful place in the world, and I get to walk out of our house and go out on the lake, and we get to fish, and we get to be near our extended family, and it's a privilege to be from there and to be connected there.
What are your favorite places there at Leech Lake?
that's hard to say. Someone else asked me that recently, and I said, well, it kind of depends on the season. I mean, you know, if it's summertime, I like to be, out on the water. And if it's the wintertime, I have an inordinate fondness for swamps. And they are unloved and unknown and secret places, but they're the places where all the life is. All the animals, all the plants, medicines, all that kind of stuff. I mean, that's where they are. I love swamps. I mean, you give me a swamp in the winter, I'm a happy man.
Well, speaking of swamps, you trap beaver too, right? How successful are you at that?
Well, I don't. Not as successful as some. It's more of a thing that I love to do, that brings me into contact with a way of living, but also with a kind of person, you know, from my homeland that I just love spending time with. So I don't trap for a living. Some people do, and they've got a tough life. It's hard to make enough money trapping to support a family, but, you know, luckily I'm a professor and I can trap for fun. I love being out there.
Well, I'm a city kid, so how do you do it?
I can't tell you my secrets, right?
I think you're probably pretty safe.
Well, I don't know. Your listeners might be taking notes. But trapping beavers, you know, you can trap in the fall before there's ice, and then you trap their runs. You trap their channels where they go to cut trees down. And then when the ice comes, you can trap the entrances to their houses by cutting through the ice
mm-hmm.
over their entrances, which takes some expertise. In terms of locating them, and sink your traps under the ice. which is, it's pretty labor intensive. If you need a workout, you know, come hang out and do some trapping, because you're chopping ice and chopping logs and hauling stuff through the snow and walking through swamps, and it's not for the faint of heart.
We're visiting with David Troyer. He's author of a new book, Res Life, and Indians' Journey Through Reservation Life. If you could only raise your kids in one place, David, would it be California or the reservation?
Oh, you know, you hit the biggest, most difficult thing
getting
in my
close
life.
Close to home here, yeah.
It's exactly it. I mean, I love my job. I love teaching, and I love teaching in a place like USC that has a lot going on and really wonderful colleagues and phenomenal students and great opportunities for you know, faculty and students. Teaching is part of who I am, and teaching in that context keeps my brain alive in ways I think that my brain wouldn't be if I didn't teach. That said, the place that's truly the most important place in the world to me is Leech Lake, and I loved growing up there, maybe not as much as I was growing up, but looking back. And I want my kids to have that too, so we're trying to figure out how to do that. You know, it's early yet, the kids are young, but that's going to be, you know, our life work, to keep our kids engaged with the bigger, broader world, and to keep them grounded at Leech Lake. That, to me, is both parts of that are incredibly important to me.
How do you split your time now, David?
Well, I teach, and
I mean, in terms of number of months.
Probably 4 months out of the year I get to be home. And right now, 8 months out of the year here. Of course, right now, my life is going around talking about the new book. That's pretty much all I'm doing.
That's what you got to do. Yeah.
Yeah.
But 4 months out of the year, you're in Minnesota, 8 months in Los Angeles.
Right now, but I just moved to Los Angeles in August. This is brand new.
Boy,
we just down here.
Talk about two different worlds.
I know. I know. And but, you know, in a plug for California, there's a lot of wild country out here. It's not my country yet, but I'm up to the challenge. You know, the mountains to me are fascinating, and the ocean is, you know, bizarrely large, which may seem obvious, but to me it's kind of shocking.
Yeah.
And it's an adventure.
Well, if our listeners want to chime in with their questions about Native Americans in connection with David's book, Res Life, and Indians' Journey Through Reservation Life, our number here, 816-235-2888, our email address, UpToDate@KCUR.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Let's go to Mike from Lawrence. Mike, you're on UpToDate. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning. Bonjour. I know some Ojibwe, but the comment I was going to make was the whole definition of Indian country was reaffirmed by a case here in Kansas called Blue Jacket v. Johnson County Board of Commissioners, or Kansas Indians, in 1872, when the state of Kansas or Johnson County tried to tax Shawnee allotments, and there's still three or four 20 to 30 acre allotments that are still Indian trust land near DeSoto, Kansas, and that's all that's left of about 1.8 million acres that used to stretch from the Missouri border out to Waubonsie County, Kansas. But I want to say Magwitch, and I met you at KU a couple of years ago, and good luck.
Hey, thanks. You know, Kansas has both a bloody and fascinating history and a really vibrant Indian present. I mean, there's a lot of Native folk in Kansas, and it's been a tough road, and you know, stay strong and more power to you. It's what you're doing out there is so important.
Mike, thank you.
Thank you.
You know, David, I want to come back to this idea, these conceptions that so many of us have about reservations, because, again, you write this, that what one finds on reservations is more than scars, tears, blood, and noble sentiment. There is beauty in Indian life. We love our reservations. Again, I think that's going to surprise a whole lot of people that you're saying that.
It might, but, it felt true to me. Like, the party line, the status quo, the received notion of Indian life is that our lives are, you know, brutal, nasty, and short, and or brutish, nasty, and short, and that may be for a lot of people. A lot of people have a rough go of it, but that line does not explain why so many Native people care so much about their reservation and their tribal communities, some of which aren't on reservations, right?
Mm-hmm.
And And so, you know, I wanted to get to the bottom of that. Okay, so clearly we're feeling something else. Clearly we sense that there's something else about our lives and about our communities which is not being represented or explored in the received old, the same old story.
And that's
and I wanted to find out what that is.
Why is that happening? Because that's an ongoing problem, I assume.
Yeah, it is. And I was talking about this recently, and it seems to me that, you know, there's something has intervened between us, all of us, and our understanding of our lives, right? And it seems to me, probably as a novelist and as a lit prof, as well as a Native person, that the thing that has come between us is this story about us, which is a long, you know, cherished, you know, almost impossible to eradicate story, which is basically a story of our suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So that has come between us and an understanding of our lives. And so I think that I'm trying to, with this book, attack that story. Because think about it. I mean, we've been living together. We've been working together. We've been playing. We've been marrying. We've been fighting. We've been doing all this stuff for 500 years. And so you would think that there would be some depth of understanding, but there is not.
Well, but don't you think so many Americans, and maybe I include myself in this, David, that we all sort of suffer from this notion of many of us just feel guilty in a way. We, you know, we know a lot of bad things happened here that we never really made up for it. And I think a lot of people just sort of want to put it off to the side and really not confront it or think about it very much.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. You know, the story that is interceded between us and understanding of us is a story of tragedy, and it has a social function. People are allowed to feel pity, they're allowed to feel fear, and they experience a kind of catharsis, this release of intense emotion, and they move on. And that is how guilt has been dealt with, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're exactly right. This, the way that people tell the story of Indian lives lets people off the hook. And frankly, I wrote this book to keep us all on the hook.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, hopefully we can squirm a bit, because I don't think there's anything wrong with squirming.
It's
productive.
And the book keeps us on the hook in what way, do you think?
I try not to give us access to that kind of hermetically sealed, kind of sterile, tragic story. I try to show that we are not dead. We are still going. We are still active. We have more power than we thought, and we haven't always used it well. There's more going on, and we are still implicated. America's crimes aren't, you know, not to sound too you know, revolutionary, but America's crimes aren't just crimes of the past,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all of us is still bathe in those every day. And I think we should think about it, as well as our successes, too, because there's lots of good things. I'd rather be Native in the United States than Native in a place like Guatemala or the Congo or someplace like that, because those places are suffering in ways that we can't begin to imagine.
So what would you like to see this country doing right now when it comes to Natives? I mean, should there be reparations? Should that not be the way we go? Should there be some statement from the government? Or do you just want to see attitudes begin to change from rank-and-file Americans here?
Well, you know, I mean, the book is meant to correct a way of seeing it. And people's behaviors are up to them. But I can say that you look at Canada, and Canada's had a lot of problems in the past, and the Canadian government apologized for its policies. That apology, it only goes so far, but it did say something to communities, Native communities. It meant something. The Catholic Church apologized to Natives in Canada for the residential boarding school system. That apology, you know, went a long way. The Canadian government has started paying reparations for Native kids who were forcibly removed from their homes and sent to residential boarding schools where they suffered horrendous abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that has also had a profound effect just on the psychology of Native, non-Native relations. I disagree strongly that a government or a person puts themselves in a position of weakness when they make an honest accounting and apology for their behavior.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the start of a process which is complicated and uncomfortable, but ultimately can be really productive.
We're talking about Native Americans with author David Troyer, his new book, Res Life, An Indian's Journey Through Reservation Life. Again, our number, 816-235-2888. Our board is full. Option 2, email up to date at kcur.org. Let's go to Jeff. Let's go to Jeff here from Blue Springs. Jeff, good morning.
Good morning. I had just a question. There seems to be a kind of a long-held stereotype among certain people of a higher alcoholism rate among Native Americans, part of it promulgated through Hollywood and so forth, and just wanted to get a comment on that.
Alcoholism on reservations, David. You deal with this in the book.
Yeah, it's complicated because, one, it is a stereotype, and two, it actually is a problem. So it's both things, right? So we need to find some way to address the stereotyping, which again doesn't really lead to any kind of productive action, but the problem does exist, right? Not relegated just to Indian communities. You know, for example, in northern Minnesota, alcoholism is a big problem among rural poor, right? Not just in reservation communities. And it's longstanding, and it's both historical and it's individual. There are reasons, you know, related to historical traumas why alcohol continues to be a problem, and there are reasons which are personal, and you know, we need to hold each other accountable in ways that change the dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really complicated.
How much work is being done on that issue, do you think, across the country when it comes to natives right now?
I think a lot of people have been working in that way for a long time, and in a number of ways. I mean, 12-step programs have had a huge, you know, impact across the country, and especially so on reservations. But also, a lot of Native folk across the country are turning back to traditional culture, life ways, ceremonies, and that has even an even more profound impact on addressing the issue of alcoholism. And you find in communities that have largely returned to, you know, traditional life, that they've been really effective at curtailing the ravages, I suppose, of alcohol.
And you talk about that as one of the reasons to be hopeful, this return to traditional life, this return to practice of Aboriginal languages, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, like, there's been a resurgence of interest in Ojibwe ceremonies, and these are ceremonies we share with other tribes, like Potawatomi. And in Kansas, who've kept a lot of these ceremonies alive through incredible hardship and censorship.
And it's a hopeful sign for you, David. Why? Why is it a hopeful sign?
It's a hopeful sign because, you know, people are bringing back what was thought to have been, you know, either been killed completely or so diluted or compromised as to be not viable. But what's really great is that instead of seeing traditional Indian life as opposed to separate from modern life, in fact, what we're seeing now are modern, wired-in, you know, hooked-up Indian people who are traditional people, you know, living, working in the modern world, and there's no tension between the two. And they're going about it in a healthy way, and they're working hard. And to me, I'm just proud of these people.
Yeah.
I'm so proud of what they're doing.
Let's go to David from Overland Park. David, you're on with David Troyer. Good morning. You there, David? Let me ask you this, David Troyer. Casinos, are they good or bad?
Well, I don't know.
I mean, what do you see in terms of when they're on reservations? Have they produced good results for natives, or has it been an issue?
Well, what about, you know, let's look at American corporations, good or bad?
Well, okay.
You know, I mean, American corporations are both.
But this is a fairly recent trend.
Oh, yeah, it's fairly recent. It's 35 years old. You know, I mean, that's, I guess, pretty recent.
But you hear about these things, uplifting lives, money that wasn't available for in big amounts. You would think that maybe that would have some impact that would be notable in one way or the other.
It absolutely does. I mean, you know, tribes don't levy any kind of sales or income taxes on their residents or even on the travelers who travel there. So, you know, we're reliant on government grants and sort of treaty annuities and things like that and government funding to pay for any kind of infrastructure, any kind of development that we need to engage in. Casinos, however, provide revenue sources for roads, for schools, for hospitals, for housing for the elderly, for all sorts of things like that, for lawyers. Lawyers are indispensable in this day and age, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, casinos have had a profound impact. In places where there's no industry, they provide employment, not just for Native people. In some counties in Minnesota, you know, the casinos are the largest employers of anybody, mm-hmm. of any company or corporation. So they're helping the rural poor. They're helping in Florida. They bail out the Florida state school system on a regular basis when they go bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
They're floating the entire educational system in some ways in Florida, and ditto to some extent in California. It's amazing. But also, casinos have had a negative impact in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, communities that might have held on to sort of traditional lifeways, ricing, for example, reservation in Minnesota, everyone used to rice for money. That was it was a healthy food. It was something that families did. It's an active exercise.
You mean cultivate but, rice, you mean?
Well, no, it's wild rice.
Okay.
People don't cultivate it.
Okay.
It grows wild.
Okay, gotcha.
But they would harvest it, you know.
Mm-hmm, right.
And but they got just enough per capita from their casino that no one wanted to rice anymore because it's hard work, so everyone stopped. Now only a few families in that community really know how to rice, and most people don't.
Let's go back to David from Overland Park, who's called us back. David, good morning.
Good morning. Sorry about that. My phone got dropped.
That's all right.
I was curious. I really want to read this book, but I haven't had the chance yet. And I was wondering how, if at all, it addresses the question of the way the various tribes are dealing with their membership roles at the moment.
Yeah, the question is about enrollment. That's a complicated issue, and it's addressed, you know, in the book in some ways.
And what is the issue, David? Just explain it to folks.
The issue is that, you know, to be an enrolled member of a federally recognized tribe, at this point, and the criteria vary from tribe to tribe, but the only real criteria is that of blood quantum. What percentage of your blood is Native from the particular tribe in question? Now, some tribes just use a system of lineal descent. You just have to prove you're descended from somebody on a treaty roll in the 19th century. Other tribes require upwards of 50% blood. It's complicated, and casinos make this complicated. Some small bands that are casino rich, these are isolated cases, this isn't widespread, refuse to enroll eligible enrollees because it would dilute their per capita payments.
Hmm.
So there's greed figures into enrollment in some cases. In most cases, it doesn't. But I don't think that enrollment, which was begun as a way to breed the United States government out of its responsibilities, they figured that there'd be so much intermarriage over the course of a few generations, technically there'd be no Native people left and the federal government would no longer be on the hook.
Yeah.
So this is a system started by the federal government. It's a system based on exclusion, and it creates problems. And I don't think that Indian communities are so strong that we can afford to alienate, you know, our own people on the basis of kind of bizarre blood quantum laws. Those are important. We have to honor blood, but I think we should honor other things like hard work.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here with David Troyer about his new book, Res Life, An Indian's Journey Through Reservation Life. We'll talk about the day he spent in court, presided over by his mother, who's a judge, and what he observed that day. And later on this hour, Brian McTavish joins us with our weekend to-do list. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our conversation yesterday about mothers who are also runners, you'll find that in our talk about how Kansas City is attracting conventions, or not attracting them, at kcur.org. Monday, one correspondent stories of covering the war in Afghanistan, plus one woman's story about her father reading to her every night until she went off to college. This hour, we're visiting with David Troyer. He's written a book about taking an inside journey. It's titled Res Life, An Indian's Journey Through Reservation Life. You know, David, we were talking before. I mentioned about your mother, who's a judge on the reservation. You spent a day with her that you write about in the book. In court, it was presided over by your mother. You watched 11 cases that day. What did you make of it? What did you see there?
Well, it was frightening to see my mother in black robes. and I got the feeling that every time I got in trouble in high school, like she probably wanted to put them on and sit above me and pass judgment. Mm-hmm. But it was an interesting day in court. There were 11 cases. If memory serves, 9 of them were in some way or another related to some kind of substance abuse, mm-hmm. Either that precipitated whatever crime they were there to stand for, or it was the crime itself, or they violated some kind of condition of a previous arrangement or something like that. But it was involved in all the cases, in 9 of the cases.
She's a judge in a tribal court. What is that exactly, and how does it differ from other courts?
Well, as with any answer about reservation life, I always feel mealy-mouthed in that you can't say definitively yes or no. Every answer is, well, it's kind of and half and sort of. And so in the case of Indian law, with the passage of the Major Crimes Act in the 19th century, a lot of major crimes fell under federal jurisdiction, murder, rape, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then many of the other crimes, not defined as major crimes, remained within the tribe's purview to deal with as they saw fit. And so beginning a long time ago, these aren't that recent, although they've grown in the last 30 years, tribal courts have sprung up. We've had tribal courts in this country, and I don't know the exact number of years, but maybe as long as 80, 90 years. Of course, we've had our own justice systems, from tribe to tribe for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
But courts, as we recognize them, are maybe a century old, although they've grown a lot in the last 30 years. And most of them can handle complicated stuff, and they handle a lot of civil cases. They handle criminal cases, but not the major crimes. And it's really, aside from what crimes can and cannot be prosecuted in which tribal courts and where, they've had a different impact, which is that for the first time for a lot of Native folk, they appear before a judge who is Native like they are, and they have their case argued, the defense or the prosecution, sometimes both, argued by lawyers who are also Native, in a courtroom in their community, mm-hmm. not at the county seat. It's very, you have to imagine what it's like to have to go to the county seat in a town that could be very racist, very exclusive, mm. and to go there and to have your fate decided is, adds a whole other layer of anxiety and powerlessness and difficulty in what's already probably a difficult life if you're in court at all. So imagine being able to go to court in your hometown with people not unlike you and to feel that you're getting a fair shake. And my mother, I'm really proud of her because she obstinately always and has always taken the high road,
mm-hmm.
and never played politics and never gone the easy route, never made the easy decision. Because it would have served her or would have been less of a headache or would have caused fewer problems. I'm very proud of her.
If the case is something, an assault case or an aggravated assault case, is that case handled in the county seat?
Sitting here in this chair, I cannot remember, and it mm-hmm. depends. Some courts have jurisdiction over those cases. Some courts don't. And again, it's there's no absolute standard where you can be sure of what's going to happen in what court, and what kinds of cases can be tried. But I think assault is largely something that tribal courts and aggravated assault can try.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't say that with 100% confidence.
Well, give us an example of how ancient tribal law is sometimes integrated into modern law in the courts on the reservations.
Well, that's something I think tribal courts are moving more toward. But I think in among the Iroquois Confederacy, among the Haudenosaunee, I think that there are sentences that can be passed down. Banishment was a very tough sentence, which has been a part of their tribal judicial code for centuries, reserved only in very extreme cases. Banishment often meant either a hard life or death, and banishment is something that I think they still practice on rare occasion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as opposed to, you know, sitting in jail time or community service or things like that.
David Troyer is our guest. He's the author of a new book, Res Life and Indians' Journey Through Reservation Life. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, our email address, update@kcur.org. Roger writes us with this email, David: when will Native Americans learn that separate will always mean not equal? As long as they insist on remaining separate, they will never fully become a part of a greater nation and always will be second class. David Troyer, how do you respond to that?
Well, Canada is separate. You know, Canada is a sovereign nation. You know, Native American tribes are sovereign nations. And besides, we're not even separate, right? We have a unique status, and mm-hmm. it's something that is both precious and complicated. Your caller recognizes that much. You know, frankly, we've been integrated in the sense that we have fought in every American war on the side of America since the Revolutionary War.
Hmm.
We have helped win every American engagement, right? We have been integrated. We have been working, building skyscrapers, farming, teaching, you know, alongside and with every other American. So we are integrated, you know, that we have sovereign status, that we have a kind of dual citizenship, tribal enrollment and U.S. citizenship, does not make us second-class citizens, you know. The legacy of colonialism makes us second-class citizens,
hmm.
right?
Right.
Our own difficulties, some of our own making, perhaps sometimes make us second-class citizens, but being Native certainly does not, and belonging to a reservation certainly does not, you know. I think of it as a privilege. It's a wonderful thing. I'm an American, and I'm an American Indian, and I'm proud of being both. And so, you know, to your caller, I would say, you know, to the person who wrote in that question, you know, think about sovereignty. Maybe read the book.
I wanted to ask you about some of the people you write about in this book, and one of them is your grandfather, 83-year-old Eugene Seeley. Tell us about him.
Well, how much time do we have?
Yeah.
He was a complicated guy, and I write about him in the book, and I write about his death a little bit in the book, and that kind of, he was a World War II vet. He was a veteran of D-Day and a veteran of Battle of the Bulge, and he lived his entire life on Leech Lake Reservation, except for the years that he served in the Army, 3 years, and he was a complicated guy. The war hurt him. You know, the war changed him in ways that were not all positive. He was a complicated guy with whom I really didn't have a good relationship as a kid. We weren't close. He kind of frightened me. And but in the last 10 years of his life, I have to say, we became, it seems to me, incredibly close. And I'd gone to the places he fought. I went to the beaches. I went to the Ardennes. And I think that created a bond between us that didn't exist before. And it was really important to me to, as I thought about his life, you know, after his death, to find a way to think about his life that didn't cheat him, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that if I just saw his life as some sort of sad struggle, I would have been cheating him, because I think his life was more than that. I think it was a lot more, despite his difficulties. And so, as I thought about his life, you know, it seemed to me like with this book, I had the same task. I had to find some way not to cheat ourselves, not to cheat us, but also, you know, not to write a book that was just about laying blame, It's not a book of blame. It's not a book of pointing fingers. You know, it's a book that I hopefully tries to explore and capture what's truly complex, sometimes painful, sometimes exuberant, but always complex aspects of Indian life.
David, why did you...
I felt like I had to do that with him as well as with my entire subject.
Why did you go to those beaches where he had fought?
He and I were visiting. I'd gone to France for book stuff, and I came back to the reservation, and the day I got back was at the grocery store, and I saw my grandfather at the grocery store, and he says, "Where you been?" You know, this is, we weren't that close. And I knew he'd fought in the war, but didn't really know much beyond that. And I said, "Well, I was in France." He says, "Oh, yeah, where at?" And I said, "Well, I went to Brittany." I said, "That's kind of northern." He said, "I know where Brittany is." And so then, I thought that he'd fought in D-Day, and so I kind of goaded him. I couldn't believe I was doing this. I said, "Oh, when did you land at Normandy? You know, June 8th, June 9th? Of course, the landing was on June 6th.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "June 6th? That's when I landed. Day one." And I was like, "Oh, okay." I said, "Well, why don't you come over? I'm making dinner for Mom." And he actually came over to the house. And for some reason, maybe just because I'd been there, where no one in the family had ever been other than him.
That's a great story.
He started talking about D-Day. He started talking about the Battle of the Bulge. And he didn't stop talking for about 3 or 4 hours, and it was kind of shocking. And he talked about these places he'd gone, and in particular one place in Belgium where he had spent a lot of time and where they were bivouacked in some chateau. And I said, "You know, I'll go there, see if I can find it." And so when I went back the next time, I, you know, dragooned a friend of mine, and we went up there, and we found the places where he'd been, and we took pictures. And I think that meant a lot to him.
I mean, he
would never say such a thing, but I think just that someone else had stood where he stood, it made what he'd done more significant or more real or something like that. But it changed our relationship entirely. It enabled us to become friends.
That's a great story, David. That's a terrific story.
Yeah.
And listen, thanks so much for your time today. I sure enjoyed having you, and I think you shed a lot of light on a topic that is good for people to hear about. I'm glad to have
you. Thank you. Yeah, I'm so happy to do it, and thanks so much for having me.
Thanks again, Dave, and all the best to you.
Take it easy. Bye-bye.
That's David Troyer. He's the author of a new book, Res Life, and Indian's Journey Through Reservation Life.